When you take children away from their parents, when you take children away from their community and from their culture and from the land that reflects back to them who they are, you pull the roots of their being out of the earth, and the people lose themselves, and the earth loses itself, and all is lost. It was September, and the night was deeply dark and cold. Sitting on a log by an open fire, I can see my exhaled breath. There has been bannock and fresh white fish for dinner, and a venison is cooking slowly underground in preparation for tomorrow's meal. I am 600 kilometers north of Regina, camping in a boreal forest outside the town of Lac L'Orange. This town, central to the 10,000-strong Cree Nation of northern Saskatchewan, sits on the edge of the Precambrian Shield. The year is 1980, and I am on assignment for the CBC radio, where I occasionally contribute stories. Usually my stories are light, humorous ones, but this one might not be. There are two of us who are non-Aboriginal, a photographer who drove us up here and myself. Everyone else is Aboriginal. In 1980, First Nations people across North America have been organizing for about a decade now to raise public awareness about and for the conditions of Native people. The American Indian Movement, or AIM, was part of the continental consciousness raising and social activism of the 1970s. They were part of the Rainbow Coalition, which included the Black Panthers, the Brown Berets, and the White Panthers. AIM focused on the renewal of Indigenous culture and values and revitalization of Aboriginal spirituality. Members of AIM had been on the run from the FBI and the RCMP after the Wounded Knee massacre and the Pine Ridge murders of two FBI agents. Leonard Peltier had escaped over the Canadian border and had been recently arrested in Hinton, Alberta. There are rumors that AIM is reorganizing in northern Saskatchewan, and this is why I have been sent up there. I am 23 years old, and I am completely out of my depth. With my eyes and my ears open, but with no more than a naive understanding of the situation, I do not invite trust from those around me. I do not understand the 200 plus years of political and cultural genocide has almost been accomplished. I do not understand the effect that residential schools had on the fabric of Native communities, to their identity, to their relationships, to their family. I do not understand the terrible political forces that these people, moving away from the fire, away from me, holding meetings in the dark that I am not invited to, are facing every day. I am like most post-colonial Canadians. I am so deeply part of the dominant culture that I do not have the eyes to see what is happening right in front of me. Part of the privilege of being part of this dominant culture is I don't have to see what I don't want to see. At that time, I didn't know that the largest residential school in Canada was just 2.5 hours drive south of me in Prince Albert. Although it had been closed since 1964, the Prince Albert Residential School had boasted at one time of having over 550 students. Did I have any idea at the time what the impact would be on Aboriginal communities where 150,000 children were taken from their families? None. In 1980, I knew nothing about residential schools. I didn't know that the residential school system was a formalized government campaign to take the Indian out of the child, quote, to strip them of their Aboriginal identities and force them to adopt European values, beliefs, and customs. I didn't know that Duncan Campbell Scott, an early 20th century senior official with the Department of Indian Affairs, said it was the government's, quote, objective to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politic, and there is no Indian question and no Indian department. I knew but hadn't absorbed the fact that in the early 20th century, Native ceremonies were outlawed under threat of imprisonment, nor that for years, Native people were not allowed off their reserves without written permission from the government Indian agent. As one person said, there were more subtle things happening too, like parents refusing to teach their children the language because they knew if they had an Indian accent, they couldn't get a job, unquote. How did I not pull all of this together and understand the consequences of 150 years of political policy that legislated away everything that rooted Native people to the land and to their identity? How is it that we can both know the facts about something and at the same time not really fathom the total injustice of it? It has to do, to answer my own question, it has to do with the colonization of the Americas. It has to do with the concept of manifest destiny, which is the belief that Europeans were directed by God to rule over this new world and subjugate its people, who were, in all ways, they believed, inferior. It has to do with a failure of imagination and a process of compartmentalization, in that it happened to those people. It wasn't my brother who went off to school and never returned. It wasn't my sister who was sexually assaulted and spent her life in fear and self-loathing. Nor was it my community that had its rites, its ceremonies, and its spirituality criminalized. The invisible blinders that I wore were a manifestation of my place in this dominant culture, the ruling class. So when faced with the facts that I could easily see, I could easily say, it wasn't my problem to solve, nor even think about. And many in Canada were affected with the same lack of awareness, the same denial of reality. In 1990, Phil Fontaine, three-time elected leader of the Assembly of First Nations, spoke publicly about his experience of abuse in residential schools. But the mainline media, they didn't want to carry the story. It was like a Teflon story. You know, it hit the Teflon pan and slid off. Not our problem, said the public media. It is part of our history, my history, perhaps yours, all of ours, that too few Canadians wanted to know or understand or could fathom the injustice of what was being done to Aboriginal people. It is part of our history, part of our story. The times, they have changed. As Buffy St. Marie said in an interview on Q, the radio show, she says, things change. Think back 100 years. Think back 50 years. Think back 20 years. Things change. And the work accomplished by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the facts of how the First Nations people were treated, has finally penetrated the mainstream media. And we can begin to absorb what it means for each of us and for the country that we call Canada. The work of reconciliation that we are being asked to enter into is enormous and enormously important, and in some ways quite simple. The first piece of reconciliation that we need to do, for especially for non-Aboriginal people, we are being asked to simply listen and learn. We are being asked to listen to the experience of our neighbors, to not shut our eyes and our ears, but listen respectfully with our hearts. Listen and absorb the pain and the struggles that our neighbors have gone through. We're not being asked to be ashamed, or we're not being made to feel guilty. We're being asked to sit and listen and understand. And when we begin to really soak up into our beings what has been done to these people, we will have feelings, we will be moved. And that just means we're starting to let those protective blinders down, slip away, dissolve, and that we are beginning to get it. The next step of reconciliation is to look into our own lives and uncover the stories of our own history. For example, how did I get so close to that First Nation Aboriginal experience and still fail to get what was happening? I said it was naivete earlier, which I think was true in part, and perhaps shyness on my part. But it was also that my life had not prepared me to ask these deeper questions or to reach out and risk relating with people who I felt were different from me, who I felt intimidated by their life experience and culture and otherness. It wasn't in my education. It wasn't in my history class. So, yet, I was also there. This uncomfortable in my white person CBC cultural identity, I was there risking that uncomfortableness because at some level I sensed, even though I couldn't or didn't understand, that this was really, really important. That something important was happening in northern Saskatchewan in 1980 and 70 and 90 and all of that. Did I know that I was touching on the edges at that time of a renewal in Canadian Aboriginal history? No. No, I did not know that. Though those signs were there. I do remember listening to two 20-something Aboriginal women say that their work in the renewal of their people was to have more children. That if the Aboriginal nations were to survive, they had to grow in numbers. That they knew was their calling, their work. And could they have known that 35 years later, the First Nations in Canada is the fastest growing population in the country? And that 28% of the Aboriginal urban population is under 25 years of age? They might have had that vision. Could they have seen that 3 decades later, First Nations people would be elected to the federal government and to the provincial legislature and would be top novelists and filmmakers and musicians that the mainstream culture media looks up to? Could they have foreseen at that time the creation of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission? What does it mean for us to be part of a religious movement that is committing itself to be part of this reconciliation process? I'm going to quote the Reverend Meg Roberts, who has represented our movement many times at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She's a part-time minister in Comox on the island, and she spoke here in November of last year. She writes, "What does reconciliation involve for me? Learning more about what happened and is happening to Aboriginal people in Canada, acknowledging the wrong and what led to it, not getting trapped in feelings of shame for things that I did not do, instead owning what I could have done in my lifetime and didn't do, acknowledging my feelings and forgiving myself. Then finding out what I can do now in the process of healing and advocating for proper redress and justice. Reconciliation is based on the process of building a relationship again, which is founded on seeing the worth and dignity of all those involved. It means risking being vulnerable when getting to know others. It means knowing I will make mistakes and not letting that stop me. Owning them, learning from them, apologizing, offering redress, taking the time to rebuild trust. And it means staying engaged in the process with humility and humor." And she also asks us, "What does reconciliation mean for you? How do you want to engage in the truth, healing, and reconciliation process?" I have 2 suggestions. Read, look at our theme page. Okay? If you didn't receive one last Sunday, there's some at the back. It's also online. There are suggestions there for exploration and questions for conversations. We have small groups that meet in the during the month, Soul Matters, Theology Pub, where this month we are going to be talking about our work for reconciliation. I encourage you to ask yourselves, what is your story in relationship to the history of the First Nations people? What did you grow up with? What did you understand? What did you not learn? What have you absorbed? What blinders do you wear? What assumptions do you carry? Or stereotypes do you hold? And what will you risk? Later in the year, Beacon will have the opportunity to participate in one of the Truth and Reconciliation curriculums that is being put together by the Reverend Meg Roberts, the Reverend Samaya Oakley, and our own Casey Thorne Stainsby, who's downstairs with our children. I've offered Beacon as one of the congregations to test these educational programs, and we're looking at dates in April. As the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Justice Maria Sinclair, said, "It was the education system that contributed to this problem in this country, and it's the education system that will help us get away from this." Reconciliation is about risking relationship. Reconciliation is countercultural because it's putting ourselves into a situation where we are risking being changed through creating real relationship. And real relationship, when people really get to know each other, is myth-busting, wall-breaking, and stereotype-ending. It's not about one person being less than another or someone being superior. It's about all of us. All of us standing on the same ground, eye to eye and heart to heart. May the journey continue.